sorry for the delay in getting started. I sort of feel like maybe many of us have accomplished the hardest thing of the day by getting here. So this Health and Human Services Budget Division will be doing an overview of the Continuing Care Division, the base budget review. So we'll begin with Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lauren Coleman, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care at the Department of Human Services. I'll begin the presentation on continuing care programs on page 156. Please note that some of the budget pages within the continuing care section of your book, the adult mental health and chemical dependency grants, are managed by Chemical and Mental Health Administration and have been already presented, so we'll skip those when we get to them, and I'll point that out as we move through the book. Our continuing care programs in Minnesota touch over 350,000 people annually. These services range from 24-hour institutional care and long-term care facilities for approximately 36,000 individuals per month to 83,000 people who are receiving congregate or home-delivered meals, or 19,000 deaf and hard-of-hearing consumers, or 90,000 individuals on an annual basis who call the linkage lines for one-to-one counseling. We partner with counties, health plans, public agencies, and private for-profit and not-for-profit agencies to deliver those services. Our overarching goal is to help older Minnesotans and people with disabilities so that they can be independent, retain, or improve their quality of life, and be participants and contributors to their communities. We manage very large programs, as you can see on page 157 and 158, that state funds are approximately $3.5 billion for the biennium and $6.5 billion where federal match is concerned. Moving to a specific area of continuing care, the aging and adult services on page 159. Aging and Adult Services Division pays for the non-medical social services portion of a person's life and provides funding for communities to develop those informal supports to keep older people engaged and participants in their communities. Generally speaking, people in these programs need to be at least age 60 or older, and we target the programs for those individuals who have the greatest social and economic needs. Much of what we do in the Aging and Adult Services Division is in conformity to the Older Americans Act. Let me highlight some examples of programs that are managed in the Aging and Adult Services. A variety of nutritional services, including meals, grocery delivery, nutrition, educational counseling, and related services. Transportation services, chore services, and other social support services. Assistance with daily activities for frail older adults. Information and assistance through our senior linkage line, minnesotahelp.info, and other long-term care planning tools. We do a fair amount of counseling about Medicare, supplemental insurance, long-term care insurance options for consumers. We provide respite and other supportive assistance to family caregivers, including options for consumer-directed supports. And we devote a considerable amount of time to developing and expanding home and community-based services and housing options for older Minnesotans. There's some background on page 159 about the Older Americans Act that was passed in 1965 by Congress. We try to measure how well we're doing with some key statistics. On page 160, you'll see that we are monitoring the proportion of public funds that are going to institutional care versus community care settings. And as you can see, the trend over the last 5 years has been a steady progression towards funding more home and community-based services and having the institutional side of the service targeted to those who really need that 24-hour care. Additionally, we monitor the number of individuals who are being served in those two settings. And again, we are now at a point in 2005 and 2006 where we are serving more publicly funded individuals in the community rather than institutions, 56.1% in the community versus 43.9% in an institutional setting. You'll see these themes throughout the Aging and Adult Services pages as we move through. On page 161A, we have a more detailed description of some specific programs that are managed within continuing care. Let me highlight a few of those and certainly would welcome any questions that you have. We have what's called the Seniors Agenda for Independent Living. This is a program that was developed many years ago. It's kind of evolved into the elder care development partnerships, and that's where we're working with communities to develop services and to integrate those services on a less formal basis in communities throughout the state. We have the Black Nurse Program, the Living at Home Black Nurse Program, which is a service of volunteer nurses and neighbors who are providing a set of services for people who want to remain in their homes. We have a variety of activity within these pages that you will see that reference drug assistance programs. As you know, over the last 18 months or so, 2 years, there's been a fair amount of need to support seniors and people with disabilities to make decisions about Medicare Part D. So a lot of the infrastructure that has been developed in Minnesota for information and assistance was devoted to that, and you can see that resources were dedicated to that series of decisions and ongoing for the future consumers who need to make choices each year about Medicare Part D. On the bottom of page 161, we begin describing some of the nutrition programs. And again, you'll see a number of references to nutritional and meal programs throughout these pages. There is no single source of funding. We're challenged with trying to assemble a variety of resources in order to meet the needs of Minnesotans throughout the state. On the top of page 161B, I'd like to highlight the Community Service Development Grants and the Community Service Grants. These were a very deliberate decision on the part of the legislature a number of years ago to enhance the development of community-based services as a result of the Long-Term Care Task Force. To date, we have funded over 200 projects throughout the state of Minnesota. We provide basically seed funding to organizations who want to develop programs for older Minnesotans, and it has been a very successful program. The far majority of the programs that have been initiated under this grant activity has been able to be sustained. But again, it's intended to help organizations demonstrate additional and new ways of supporting people in the community. Let's see. We have on 161C a few smaller but very specific grant programs that come from what's called special revenue funds. These are, again, decisions that have been made to flow specific dollars to activities, and they contribute towards the total package of trying to support people, older Minnesotans in the community. On page 161D, we begin describing some of the federal funding activity that is managed by Aging and Adult Services. Again, there's a variety of federal funds that are flowing through the department. A couple that I'd like to highlight: the evidence-based health promotion on page 161D is a federal grant that is allowing us to research and develop approaches to falls prevention. For whatever reason, and I can't articulate exactly why, Minnesota has a higher rate of falls among older people. It could be related to our reporting of falls. It could be related to our weather, as we may have experienced this morning. But statistically, we have a high incidence of falls among older Minnesotans. And so we have some dollars to look at that evidence-based initiative.
And Commissioner, who do those dollars go to?
Okay, I'm stumped already. Madam Chair, we're working with the area agencies on aging in the communities to work with organizations to demonstrate evidence-based practices.
And then would those evidence-based practices be passed on to the health plans that provide services to most?
Madam Chair, that would be the intent, to share the results so that we can encourage the practices that prevent falls. Page 161E, again, there are a couple references to nutrition grants and congregate meals, and again, serving people in the community so that they can remain independent. We have some direct service grants through Title III, the Older Americans Act, that provide for community-based social services, transportation, chore services, and similar programs. And then we also fund the AAAs, the Area Agencies on Aging, with some administrative dollars that you'll see on the bottom of page 161E, so that they have the infrastructure in which to manage the programs throughout Minnesota. Moving to page 161F, again, a variety of grants that are obtained from the federal government through the Older Americans Act. If there's any specific questions about those programs, we can try to answer that for you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you. I just had a general question, and maybe related to page F, but on E, you said these are grants that come from the federal government to pay for community-based services for elderly. And are the services paid for, or it's just paying for the infrastructure that you're talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, it pays for the direct services also.
Okay.
It funds the direct services.
Thank you.
Maybe this is a good time to just see if there are any questions about any of these pages so far.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I know that it indicates in some of these that it's distributed, how these grants are distributed to the AAAs. For example, there is the NSIP reimbursement is based on the number of meals served. But some of the others are unclear to me, are how you determine where the money goes. Is it based on the number of seniors, or the how do you distribute this out throughout the state?
Madam Chair, Senator, there's a formula that we work with the area agencies on agencies that is primarily based upon population or demographic statistics. There are also some grants that are more competitive in nature, so that the area agencies on aging need to demonstrate how they're going to serve people in their community.
Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner, the SAIL grants have been given out now for quite a few years. I'm assuming everyone in the state has received SAIL grants at some point in time. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I will have to verify that all parts of the state, but that would certainly be the intent, and to distribute them throughout the throughout the state. Madam Chair, I've been informed 83 counties have been impacted to date.
So only four counties have not received grants?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And then how long would you envision needing to continue these grants? The grants are for coordinating and integrating services.
Madam Chair, I think that there will be a continual need to continue to develop existing approaches as the demographics continue to shift, as well as new approaches that are being developed by counties, by providers, by consumer preferences.
Well, I thought that these grants were more for coordinating and integrating services than they were for planning to expand services. Counties don't actually expand the services. Pretty much it's the state that expands the services. So maybe we could get some more information about that.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to.
And then the next question that I had is in regard to the community service development grants. And I guess the question is, how closely do you look at the requests to see whether they have a plan for sustainability after their seed funding is completed?
Madam Chair, that's a very critical component of the evaluation that the that the team looks at. We're certainly very sensitive to not funding programs that don't have a high likelihood of sustainability. We're very clear that this is time limited, and organizations should not be dependent upon this source of funding and need to have that part as part of their business plan to be able to seek alternative forms of revenue through other existing programs or other opportunities. So it's a very important ingredient. We have seen very few programs not continue past the initial funding stage. It's always a challenge, though, and we hear that frequently from organizations that get to the end of their funding cycle, but we've seen very few that have actually had to cease functioning.
Other questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I represent a lot of small towns and densely populated areas and things like that. And I notice a lot in your descriptions you have the number of people served. It always looks really good when you have large numbers of people served, because that indicates you're using the dollars well. But how do you deal with small communities or small agencies or small nonprofits who serve a small population of people, because you know they're going to be expensive just looking at numbers, and how do you balance out the needs of rural places or remote places? small populations.
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, we try to be very sensitive to the no one size fits all, that it has to be specific to the needs in the community, and try to make allowances for the fact that economies of scale are not always available throughout the state, although we will encourage organizations to partner where there isn't a critical mass that allows for multiple programs in similar areas. But we try to be sensitive to the fact that older people throughout Minnesota should have the same opportunity for services, and that may take some discretion in how to fund them.
Other questions so far on this section? If not, let's go on then.
The next budget activity that I'll describe can be found on page 162, which is the Alternative Care Program. The Alternative Care Program is a state-funded program that pays for at-home care, community-based services for older adults who are at risk of becoming eligible for medical assistance. So let me just emphasize, this is state funds only, and so it does not receive a federal match. In scope, it serves about 5,000 elderly persons per month at an average cost of about $1,000. So from a cost-effective evaluation, it does help people remain in their homes for relatively few dollars. On page 162, you see a variety of examples of what this program can pay for. And again, it is intended to assist people who are interested in remaining at home. It contributes, again, towards our measurements on page 163, where we are trying to serve more people in a cost-effective home and community-based setting. It has had a number of modifications over the last number of years. And so we have seen the numbers decline and then start to increase again as people adjust to the changes in the program that have been made. It still is a valuable tool in helping those individuals who are not quite at the medical assistance eligibility stage and want to remain in their home, and without this program would likely have to enter a nursing facility in a few short months.
And I think, just to be a little more clear, the changes that have taken place in this program, one, in 2003, there were liens put on people's homes if they were receiving the service, and that was had quite a chilling effect on the program. Then we came back in 2005 and took the liens off retroactively and reduced some of the high-cost services. So the program no longer pays for assisted living or adult foster care. But it does still pay for people to remain in their homes, and there are no liens on the people's homes anymore. Are there questions about this program? Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, when you say, when you're talking about people's decision to remain in their home versus going into the nursing home, is that totally a voluntary decision on the part of the person, or is it, in other words, if they chose to go into the nursing home because whatever the reasons may be, is that their choice, or is it a combined decision that's made with medical staff, or how exactly does that decision get made?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, an individual has the choice to live where they want to live. If somebody seeks to live in a nursing facility, we would not restrict them from entering a facility. The public funding may vary depending upon their income and assets, but people have the choice to live where they want to live.
Other questions? Okay, then let's move on.
Madam Chair, continuing on page 165, we begin to describe the long-term care facilities portion of continuing care. Nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded and day programs are an important part of our health care delivery system. There is certainly a lot of activity about avoiding institutionalization, but that's not to represent that we don't respect and or need some level of 24-hour care represented by these organizations. Again, to note some of the scope, we have approximately 400 medical assistants, Medicaid-certified nursing facilities that have about 37,000 beds throughout Minnesota. We have about 224 intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded, representing about 2,000 beds. Additionally, there are 275 licensed day treatment and habilitation service sites serving about 13,000 people with developmental disabilities throughout Minnesota. Again, for reference, Minnesota peaked a number of years ago with nursing facility beds at approximately just slightly under 50,000 beds. We were a leader in the nation with the number of beds, or among the leaders in the nation. And there's been a conscious and deliberate policy direction to reduce the reliance upon the institutional model and provide more services in the community and in people's homes. A lot of the work has been done to try to work with the provider community to downsize, to close, to help manage through this transition. So we have closure programs for nursing facilities where organizations can receive a rate adjustment if they take beds out of service. They can receive a rate adjustment if they choose to do so. It's voluntary. We have the authority to negotiate planned rate closure adjustments, and we have seen a fair amount of activity over the last number of years and have paid for in the neighborhood of 6,000 beds to be taken out of the system. Some have been full closures. Some have been partial closures where facilities have chosen to create more single rooms or to create more semi-private rooms that were wards in the past. Some have a variety of reasons why they have chosen to downsize. Another part of this program is to use additional strategies to improve quality beyond the historic regulatory approach. We're all very familiar, or I shouldn't assume we're all familiar, but many are familiar with the regulatory approach, where the Minnesota Department of Health provides oversight and reviews for regulatory compliance these facilities. On the nursing facility side, we have initiative that we have partnered with the health department, which is the nursing home report card. And that is available to all consumers to look at how their specific nursing home in their community is performing among several measurements. On page 166, you will see the current component of that report card. It's been very beneficial to consumers and family members to have this piece of information in which to make a decision. It should not be relied upon as the only piece of information. There is nothing like going and visiting a facility and or talking to others who have used that facility. Additionally, we have tried to use quality measurements on the nursing facility side to encourage improvement, to encourage quality. And so we have an initiative that's called the Quality Add-on. Nursing facilities can earn part of their rate increase or could earn part of their rate increase for 2006 based upon a series of quality measures. They're a subset of the report card, and we've worked for a number of years with the stakeholders who are involved with nursing facilities to develop those quality measures and to measure those. It is a program that is in continuous evolution. We started with a set of indicators because those are what we had available through the data or through work that had already been completed. But we always have an interest in continuing to evolve those quality measures to be more outcome-based rather than input-based. And we've seen a tremendous amount of activity in the provider community to learn about how to improve those indicators that make up the report card as well as the quality add-on.
In regard to the quality add-on payments, we did that for the first time last biennium, and it's been proposed to be done again this biennium. I'm sure we'll get into that discussion when we go through the governor's budget request. But as I understand it, that additional payment made based on quality is permanent and in that nursing home's base. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. It is.
Regardless of whether they continue meeting those quality indicators or not.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
I'm not sure what to do about it. I'm not sure if the department has given it any thought, but it is a little troubling to me to think that we could be giving quality add-ons for a period of time and causing quite a disparity among the rates then of nursing homes in the same area. And then, as you know, we seem to have a propensity for homes that are lower than everybody else coming into the legislature to ask for a special rate increase for their area, because for their home, because they're not competitive with the other homes because their rates are higher. And I'm just wondering if the department's given that the phenomenon of increasing that through these quality payments any thought.
Madam Chair, we've given it a lot of thought. It's a subject of great interest to us about how we provide that balance. This particular component of the quality add-on, I would look upon as a way for facilities to earn part of their rate adjustment. And therefore, it is providing the incentive to improve quality, but it also recognizes that that money goes into the base and is needed for ongoing support. We have other proposals or other initiatives that we're implementing, which are slightly different. The pay for performance that we are in the process of implementing, which allows for a bonus payment to individual facilities based upon a negotiated amendment to their alternative payment service contract. That's another strategy to try to work with facilities to improve services specific to their particular circumstances. There are a variety of ways that we could consider providing incentives for improvement. We have no lack of ideas, but sometimes we have to make the difficult choices about how to prioritize the funds that we have available. But the topic that you are addressing has given us great internal discussion, and we haven't landed on the precise solution to how you balance providing the incentives, but at the same time making sure that it's sustainable.
Well, most of the other ways that we give payment for performance in various areas of healthcare, at least, are done annually. So you have to earn it every year. And if somebody else is catching up to you, so to speak, you might not earn it in the future. But with the nursing home bonus payments, the way they have been operated so far, that would not be the case. And I just do have to share with you concern of about creating disparities. I mean, we've done enough of that without rhyme or reason, but after a while, if we're doing it without rhyme or reason and with rhyme or reason, then, you know, it just begins to be quite a confusion. So any thoughts you have about how to remedy that as we go along would be appreciated. Are there other questions about the nursing home funding? I think this might be a good time for you, Assistant Commissioner, just to explain to people the nursing home surcharge and that and the...
Okay, Madam Chair, there is a feature of the nursing home payment structure that provides an opportunity for Minnesota to receive additional federal matching funds. And so, although I'm not an expert in the intergovernmental transfer area, we do charge a fee to the nursing facilities, which is built into their rates, and then they pay that back to us through the fee mechanism that generates additional revenues through the federal government and, I might note, through the private paying individuals who are receiving nursing facility services. It tries to provide additional funds for human service programs. That's kind of the short story of the nursing home surcharge.
Just to add a little bit, when this practice was originally begun, it was begun as a mechanism to increase nursing home payments. In 2003, there was a sizable amount added to the surcharge, which was not retained by the nursing homes, but was retained by the state to balance the budget. And so maybe you could just remind us what we're up to now in terms of the bed charge. And this is a charge that nursing homes have to pay regardless of whether their bed is filled or not. So if a nursing home has fair vacancy rate or if they have an ongoing vacancy rate, it can and I believe does put additional financial burden on that facility.
Madam Chair, the current surcharge for each nursing facility bed is $2,850 per bed per year.
$2,350.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, of that amount, how much does the nursing home, how much goes into nursing home care and what percentage goes into the general fund?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, there's not a direct correlation between the surcharge and what the payment rates are to the nursing facility.
I don't think you quite understood her question. She wants to know how much of the surcharge is returned back into higher rates for nursing homes as opposed to how much is retained by the general fund for ongoing human services programs in general. I think that was your question.
Madam Chair, I think you stated it much better in more detail. But
as opposed to a particular individual home retaining the money. I don't think we ever did it that way.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, again, I don't think that there's a direct correlation that you can take the surcharge revenue and find a direct appropriation to the nursing facility budget activity. But I'd have to rely upon our budget people to explain that a little more clearly.
Assistant Commissioner, I think if you go back and look at the history of it, you would be able to determine that, and maybe somebody can get that information for us. I doubt anybody maybe has it here today. But.
Madam Chair, we will do that for you.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner. Can you just clarify the $2,850 that's assessed? That's based on the bed in that facility, and it has no bearing on whether or not that's a private pay individual or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, it's strictly based upon licensed beds. It doesn't distinguish who's occupying the bed. So if you are, if you have a licensed bed, you are assessed that fee.
Assistant Commissioner, our fiscal staff believes that the amount is $2,815 per bed.
Okay, I stand corrected, Madam Chair. Okay.
I mean, you know, when we're getting that big in the numbers, the change maybe doesn't matter to everyone, but it might matter to somebody. And Senator Lynch, so if that bed is occupied by a private pay patient, of course, it's in the rate they pay. If it's occupied by a Medicaid patient, it's in the rate that Medicaid patient pays or what the state pays for that Medicaid patient. But if it's an empty bed, then there's nobody to pay for it except the facility. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Assistant Commissioner, I think when all of us were running for election this last time, this is one thing that came up frequently with our constituents. And it seems, at least from the public's perspective, that, I mean, and I'm sure you've heard it called the granny tax, that you have this $2,800 fee now that's being assessed to every nursing home patient or bed, and they don't get any additional nursing staff for that additional fee. There's no additional improvements that go to the nursing homes and no benefits whatsoever to the person paying the additional charge. Would you say that's true?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, I would say that there was no discernible connection between the increase in the surcharge recently and the rates that facilities were provided during that time frame.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
So that sounds like a very diplomatic way to say No, the grannies and grandpas didn't get any extra benefit from the $2,800 that they were charged.
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, the assembling the budget over the last several years has been a challenge for all of us, including the legislature. And it comprised of a series of decisions, some that were very difficult to make. And I would suggest that this was one of those that was a difficult decision, but part of the decision process to last several years.
I might just say a small defense of the proposal is that at least we weren't talking about cutting services with that particular budget page. And we were talking about cutting services with about 90% of the budget pages. So, but I think it is an area that we want to keep in mind that, you know, when and if an opportunity presents itself to change that back, that we might want to do that. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So thank you for pointing that out. We don't want to cut services to our elderly. And yet, you know, on their behalf, I would have to say that if they're carrying an extra $2,800 charge, is that a practice that we need to continue when they're getting no benefit whatsoever and our most vulnerable citizens are simply helping to balance the state budget?
Yes, I indicated I thought it was something that we should keep in mind, that I wouldn't have brought it up if I didn't think we should remember it and understand it so that we can possibly correct it in the future.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
Senator Sharon.
When we're looking at this year's budget, I'd be curious to know what the fiscal implications would be of at least not charging the empty beds. Because?
Because of the way the thing works.
Oh, no.
It's
more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, it's a rate per bed, and you can't, if you exempt anything from it, then you have to do the whole thing. It's not something you can do part of. You could reduce the amount and not do all of it, but you can't just say, well, bed A has a bed charge and bed B doesn't.
I suppose part of the problem of doing it by occupied or unoccupied bed is that changes in a 30-day period, perhaps. Some beds are occupied and then emptied and then occupied and then emptied. But it is, if the bed is empty and there is no income then at all for that bed, then it really creates a hardship on the facility.
Yes, and I believe some facilities have closed because of it. Other questions? Let's go on then.
I'll continue on page 172, where we now move more to the home and community-based side of our business. We have long-term care waivers and home care. This is a very valuable component of the services that we manage. It is the alternative to the institutional model. And if you can look upon the rules under which we operate, which is this federal-state partnership, the entitlement to the consumer, to the Medicaid recipient, is to those in need or risk of institutional services. So what Minnesota and many other states have done is sought a waiver, and we have a 20-year history of seeking permission from the federal government to provide services in a different manner than the institutional model, which was the original basis of Medicaid. We have five long-term care waivers, and they're listed on page 172. Let me try and describe some of those for you. We have the mental retardation or related conditions waiver. This program is the largest of our waivers. We have about 14,000 individuals in that particular program, 14,500, and is managed through a allocation process with the counties. They develop individual service plans with the consumer and manage them on a monthly basis. The elderly waiver, let me just note that the MRRC waiver was very instrumental in the state being able to close institutions, state institutions, where these individuals lived previously. The elderly waiver is a bit smaller. It's about 9,000 individuals who are age 65 or older who seek to live in the community. Again, it's a cost-effective program, and we are in the kind of mid-stages of transitioning this waiver program into health plans, where health plans are working at managing a more comprehensive benefit set and financing mechanism that combine basic health care as well as the home and community-based services under the elderly waiver. We're learning from that. Counties and health plans and consumers are having to learn how to manage together and integrate those services. And I would say that for the most part, it's gone well, but it has created the need for some new relationships between health plans and the counties. And we're making progress each month in learning how that can work best. The CADI, or the Community Alternative for Disabled Individuals, also serves people with disabilities. Many of these people came out of institutions also. They came out of nursing facilities or state institutions. The growth in this program has been substantially demonstrated by people with mental health needs. As, again, we're trying to reform services for people with mental illness and mental health needs, this provides an opportunity for them to live in the community and receive those services through this waiver.
Assistant Commissioner, wouldn't you say that part of the phenomenon of the growth of persons with mental illness in this program is the fact that it's only been recently that the department has opened the program up to people with mental illness? So you would expect to see some growth then over a period of time, and then it probably will level off?
Madam Chair, I think that's correct. I think that there has been some pent-up demand for services, and once again, this is a cost-effective way of helping people return to the community or remain in the community through this waiver program.
And it is our goal to make it possible for all people who suffer from mental illness or some other disabling condition who are not elderly to not be residing in nursing homes, but to be residing in the community.
Madam Chair, that's correct, and there have been very purposeful initiatives to assist those individuals under the age of 65 who wish to move from a nursing facility to the community have those opportunities. And that doesn't mean that the job is done. We still have people under the age of 65 who are living in a nursing facility that may wish to move, and we're working with counties to try to make that happen, as well as working with a stakeholder group under what's called the Options 2 initiative to identify those remaining obstacles to the approximately 2,000 individuals under the age of 65 who are currently living in nursing facilities.
And sometimes it's just a very small thing that can make a difference of whether someone can be in the community or has to remain in a nursing home. I know our office was involved with someone who was ran away, did not want to be in this nursing home, and eventually was held at one of our metro area hospitals waiting commitment to Anoka State Hospital. And because he was, his case got postponed and postponed, he was in the hospital long enough that they taught him how to give himself his own insulin. And that was what made the difference then. He no longer needed to be in the nursing home. He was not committed to Anoka, and he now and has been for several years living very successfully in the community. And that very simple thing of teaching him how to give himself his own insulin made the difference.
Moving on, Madam Chair, additional waiver that we sought and received from the federal government is the traumatic brain injury, or the TBI waiver. This is a program with very targeted, specific needs of those who have a traumatic or an acquired brain injury, who without the services in this program would again either be in a nursing facility or a neurobehavioral hospital. It's smaller in scope. It's about 1,100 individuals on a monthly basis at a cost of $4,600 per month, and it's a very targeted, specific program for these individuals. And then we have, last but certainly not least, the Community Alternative Care, the CAC program, which is for those individuals who, without this service, would have to remain in a hospital. So it's a very high acuity, high intensive level of service, but at the cost of $3,500 per month is far less expensive than a permanent hospital stay, if anybody has seen a hospital bill lately. So, again, it's important for these individuals who, without this service, would need the 24-hour care of an acute care hospital.
Assistant Commissioner, do we know how many of the people in this program are on ventilators?
Madam Chair, I don't have that data offhand, but we can research that for you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on these programs? Okay, let's move on then.
I will now move to page 193.
I think I do have one more question about continuing care in the community, and that is we have had in the budget funding to provide services to children with autism. And and one of the most recent changes in that was to give a certain type of service a higher rate. And I'm wondering if that has been implemented. I know it was on hold for a number of years during the budget deficit years, and but it was on autopilot to start at some time in the future, and I'm wondering if that has begun or if it's in the forecast to begin this biennium or where we're at with that.
I'm going to look for some support on this specific question.
Madam Chair, George Hoffman, Department of Human Services. It's in the forecast, but I think it was delayed.
Yes, it
I
was.
I think more than once.
But I can't remember when to anymore.
I think it's in the forecast starting in either FY10 or 11. I think FY10, but it has not been implemented.
Could you get us that information?
I can
get you. As to how much it is and what year it's in the forecast for?
I can do that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if to ask the Commissioner or you, Madam Chair. The workers in these facilities, when was the last COLA, or cost of living allowance, they raised? When did they receive that?
There was a long-term care COLA given in the last biennium. Most of it was not in the governor's budget. So we're glad to see something in the governor's budget this year. Not enough, but something. And it was 1.5% for each year. And you may have heard from some people who believe they did not receive a COLA increase. I have. And in investigating those issues, it seems as if the law allows a provider to either provide it in the form of direct wage increases or to offset benefits. And some of these organizations have health care that they provide for some of the employees, and some of them used it to offset increased health care costs, which did not necessarily benefit all of the employees. And so some of those employees feel that they didn't get something that they should have had. So I think we'll be having some more discussion about that when we get to talking about COLAs for this biennium and what to do about it. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is in the governor's budget this year for COLA?
2.2%, but 0.5% of that 1.5. Is earmarked for performance. So it's 1.5 for wages or health care or whatever else.
Madam Chair, that's one of the biggest issues I hear, too, down in my district is the COLA issue.
Right.
As workers, it's definitely a labor of love.
And I do think that, you know, there are some folks that are a little perturbed that the long-term care providers that work directly for the state would be getting 3.25 and 3.25 in the governor's budget, but those who work in the community would be getting 1.5 and 1.5.
Madam Chair,
Commissioner, we'll get into this more when we have the discussion of the governor's budget proposal, I'm sure. Yeah.
Madam Chair, for the record, and it's probably not testifying 101, but you indicated 1.5% COLA in the past, and 10106, the long-term care providers received 2.25% COLA adjustment. So just wanted to make sure that we're dealing with the right data. The years get kind of confusing.
Yes, I did not remember that correctly, so thank you.
Moving on, page 193 describes our deaf and hard of hearing programs. Again, for context, there's approximately 60,000 Minnesotans who are deaf and almost 500,000 of us who have some sort of hearing loss. There are several very targeted programs that we manage within deaf and hard of hearing grants. First is the Sign Language Interpreter Referral Services. Again, its intent is to provide access to core services such as court proceedings, educational programs, mental health services, law enforcement, medical care, etc. We have a very proud record in Minnesota of recognizing the needs of deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind Minnesotans and making sure that they have the full access to services that many of us take for granted. A lot of the services also and deaf and hard of hearing are targeted to deaf-blind individuals. And the intent is so that they can live as independently in the community as they wish, that they can remain in their homes. We also provide funding support to families and deaf-blind children who are attempting to be integrated into communities and present unique challenges to the parents and the family. We also have some very targeted programs for mental health services for individuals who are deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind. The combination of those disabilities along with mental health needs require a very specific set of services and set of skills by providers in order to help them manage their lives. And then the fourth area of focus in the deaf and hard of hearing division is real-time television captioning in Greater Minnesota so that those individuals have access to live local news programming. And that's important for those people to stay connected with what's happening in their community. On page 194, we have some measures that we are tracking, trying to evaluate how good a job we're doing. Again, part of our initiative is to train and have available certified interpreters throughout Minnesota. And you can see that we are exceeding our target on those who are passing the national certification, and then doing a very nice job on the percent of interpreter services requests that are filled. It's at 97% if we have 24 hours advance notice through the various programs that I recently indicated, and 91% if you consider all requests. And again, there's some other measures that we're tracking. How good a job are we doing with serving this very specific, important population?
Are there questions about this program?
On page 196A, Madam Chair and members of the committee, has a little more detail on some of the deaf and hard of hearing grants for your consideration. We will now skip to page 207, where we have a series of other grant activity that we manage within continuing care. There are basically four areas that I'm going to highlight. The Family Support Grant, again, I'll note that this is state dollars, and its intent is to provide some cash assistance to families to purchase supports for a child with a disability. There are approximately 1,650 children who are receiving an annual grant of about $2,500 per year per child. This is trying to help families recognize that there are higher costs associated with raising a child with a disability. And sometimes this small cash infusion makes all the difference in allowing the parents to do the job that they want to do in working with their children. Some of the allowable expenses could include some respite care, some technology such as computers, some day services, some specialized clothing, special dietary needs, special transportation that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. These individuals who are receiving the Family Support Grant are not individuals that are on one of the waivers that I described earlier. So it's strictly a cash support so that they can make decisions based upon their family needs.
But this program does also have some income guidelines, right?
That is correct. There is an income threshold that you have to meet in order to be eligible.
I think it says here an annual gross income of less than $82,657.
And I'm sure that's correct. The next grant that we're managing is the Consumer Support Grant. And again, this is helping individuals and their families to purchase supports that allow people to live as independently as possible. It supports about 850 individuals currently at an average annual cost of about $9,800. Again, it is intended to provide adaptive aids, home modifications, respite care, home care, etc. It is limited to the amount that the state would be providing for long-term care services under a Medicaid program. So the other programs that we've described earlier have both state and federal funds. Well, this is a decision with the consumer that says, I can do better, I can do more with the flexibility of receiving just the state funds and still be able to remain independent. So it's a very targeted but important program for the several hundred individuals in the program. The semi-independent living skills is administered through counties, and again, it assists individuals with mental retardation or related condition to live successfully in their community. It's a partnership with the state and the counties. So the counties do have a share of funding semi-independent living skills. These are for a portion of the population that are not at risk of institutionalization. So they go through an assessment. They don't need that level of service, but still they need some amount of support to remain independent. It could, some examples of services, nutrition education, meal planning preparation, shopping, first aid training, money management, personal care and hygiene. This is for people with MR and related condition who are higher functioning and, again, need a targeted amount of support to remain independent. The last area of this other grant activity is the HIV program. The HIV AIDS division is a program within continuing care. It is a extraordinarily complex program for from a financing mechanism because we have a variety of federal dollars that are flowing to the state as well as a state appropriation. It's very targeted to those who are living with HIV/AIDS, and it is a very person-centered program in that the needs of each individual need to be actively managed. Some examples of activity within the HIV/AIDS program. We are the payer of last resort, so we go through a lot of activity to make sure that people who have access to other funding streams, be that medical assistance, be it Minnesota Care, be it private insurance, are accessing those financing streams. Additionally, we help people who have private insurance continue with that private insurance product. So there's an insurance supplemental activity within this program, because that's more cost effective. If somebody is eligible for health insurance, they're employed and they have that availability, it's certainly more cost effective to help them with some of that premium payment rather than see them go without insurance and the kind of cascading effect that it could have. The critical nature of this program is the medical care and medical regimes that are required with HIV AIDS is very, very, very critical, very life sustaining. If you do not have availability of drugs, certain drug regimes for, in some cases, even a single day, then that makes that particular drug regime no longer effective in treating the illness. And you start over with a whole series of new drug regimes or searches for managing the HIV. There are social services, and we'll talk a little bit later about the federal funds that are flowing into Minnesota. The challenge with this program is that people are living longer with HIV/AIDS. The medical interventions, the pharmaceutical interventions are, in fact, producing a longer life for people living with HIV/AIDS. Additionally, we are seeing younger populations present themselves with HIV/AIDS. And so that certainly is of concern, but it also presents pressures on the funding streams that are available under the HIV area. Some of the recent activity within this division, again, through the last several years, we have implemented standard practices in healthcare to preserve the and stretch the funding as well as we can, with some cost sharing, with some co-pays, with some active participation by the consumers in this program. We've also provided, though, a safety net through the Planning Council that provides for some hardship funds for those individuals who are truly unable to meet their cost share or co-pay obligations because of the critical nature of them needing to continue with their medical care.
Madam Chair.
Are there questions about any of these programs? Senator Pretner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, are these are all federal dollars that are pass-throughs and grants?
No.
Senator Berglund, Senator Solon, no. There's a combination of federal dollars as well as a state appropriation.
If you look on the yellow pages starting at 210.9, you'll see the general fund appropriations, and then later you'll see special revenue funds, and then you'll see later federal funding. Appropriations by program.
Okay.
So, and the state insurance premium grants for funding persons with HIV would be the second one on the yellow page there.
Yes. Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
So this is from the special revenue fund then? Is that
no, it says general fund. It says at the top of the left-hand column.
On 210C?
210C would be, you're moving then into the special revenues funding, and then if you get to 210D, you're looking at federal funds.
HIV. I know, it's not
labeled. And that's how all the pages in the book are laid out.
This is
awesome. We do general fund first, special revenue, and then federal funding.
Thank you.
Madam.
Yes, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner. I want to direct your attention to page 210B. I'm always particularly interested in quality initiatives, particularly when we're discussing healthcare reform. And I note that there have been some expenditures in that area, and I'm wondering over time what those deliverables have been and what kind of movement we're making.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, the activity in, identified on page 210B, the quality assurance, is a specific program in an area of the state that has been developing a quality assurance model called Region 10 that is very consumer-oriented. And really involves the consumer, the variety of stakeholders in developing that care model and care service and working with the consumer in achieving his or her goals. That is a multi-year demonstration project, and actually there is a study, and it should be released shortly, that will make recommendations based upon what has been learned through that model and how and whether we should expand that model statewide. So there is evidence that's going to be brought forward through that study for consideration by the legislature.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, I'll be particularly interested when that report comes out. Especially in light of the ongoing allocation that's been allotted to this study. I always think that it's good when we have a deliverable that we can look at and move forward with.
Well, and also especially considering that this pilot project has never been able to receive any federal funding, whereas the rest of our quality assurance programs for the rest of the state do.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
Assistant Commissioner, on this quality assurance study, is this the model where the group meets with the consumer to ask what services they want and target their programming based on the needs coming from the actual consumer rather than top-down, this is the services you need and these are the ones we're going to provide? It is one that initiates with development of the plan from the consumer itself?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that is an important component of the consumer involvement in trying to design their lives and what their goals are and how the supports, the providers, the counties that are involved in this project are able to support that.
But I would say that many of our programs are designed with that kind of a model, alternative care, our waiver programs, cash and counseling. I'm probably missing some. I'm sorry to anyone in the audience who I've overlooked. But most of our community-based services are designed with the consumer in mind and putting together a menu of services that would address that individual person's needs based on what support they have from their own home and community and what they need to supplement it. And so this is more, I mean, this initiative, you know, is trying to figure out how to assure quality in those type of programs, but it goes beyond that in terms of looking at ways to regulate the quality differently.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my understanding that the question of quality, the measurements for quality are different, if I understand this program, are a little bit different in that they ask the consumer very directly about their satisfaction or is the resources that they're getting the ones that they want.
It's one component of it, I think. Well, make sure everybody gets a report when it comes out. How's that?
I like this.
Madam Chair, pages 2A through 2D describe many of the programs that we've already been discussing. I'm not sure that there's a lot to add to the written materials.
Thought maybe we could just take about maybe 2 minutes to describe a little bit Ticket to Work.
Certainly.
Since it just finally, after about 4 or 5 years, is getting started.
Madam Chair, a significant interest on the part of the continuing care administration is to focus upon employment for people with disabilities. That's not to say employment for older people is not important, but this is really trying to focus upon the kinds of supports, the kinds of collaboration that is required to enable people with disabilities to enter the workplace and to sustain employment. We know that employment for all of us is one of the most stabilizing factors. If you have an income, you have better options for making decisions, securing housing, personal choices, et cetera, feeling good about yourself, being healthier, et cetera. So this is trying to work with other state agencies and other organizations to educate employers to work with specific consumers who wish to work, who need support to work, and that support might be coaching, it might be some support in transportation and some time management. Again, sometimes the smaller things or the littler things make the difference. Additionally, while we're on the topic of employment, we're on the early stages of implementing an additional federal grant called the Demonstration to Maintain Independence, which is targeted specifically to those individuals with mental illness. We are just beginning the enrollment process to enroll up to 1,500 individuals to, again, learn what kinds of supports work to help individuals with those particular needs obtain employment and remain employed, again, to maintain their independence. So I think that this is kind of an emerging feature within both federal and state government to focus upon employment issues. I think there's a variety of reasons why that is so, some of which is financial, some of which is self-esteem, some of which is we need more workers. There is a labor shortage, and a labor shortage that's going to grow. So as we can utilize people with disabilities and older individuals to remain employed, we can be part of the solution rather than be part of the problem.
Assistant Commissioner, if members of this committee have constituents that they think might be candidates for the Ticket to Work program, how would they put their constituents in touch with people that are involved with that?
Well, Madam Chair, they can contact our office, and we'll make sure that the people who are managing the Ticket to Work program with DEED are able to connect up with that consumer.
And Assistant Commissioner, someone that maybe isn't earning enough money to be in the Employed Persons with Disabilities program, would they be potentially a candidate for this Ticket to Work program, whereby the program might be able to help them increase their earnings so they could be in the EPD program?
Madam Chair, I don't know that that would be part of this particular program, but we would still attempt to connect those individuals with the right people to help them understand what their options are.
I thought the idea was to get people off of MA who otherwise could be employed with additional support.
Madam Chair, that is the goal, is for self-sufficiency or increased sufficiency.
So if a disabled individual is trying to get earned income, but they can't earn enough to actually qualify for the MAEPD program, which is $60 a month, this program would not be appropriate to help them?
Madam Chair, I'm going to look to staff for some support, and I'm not sure that I have that level of detail.
Okay, well, maybe you could get that to us.
Okay, certainly. Be happy.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, if I may just get some clarification, if somebody is interested, a potential employee is interested, where would they find the information, and is this program ready to go?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, this particular program is ready to go. The other program that I referenced, the demonstration to maintain independence, is in an enrollment phase currently. So that is also ready for applicants.
Okay.
And they would be enrolled if they were eligible.
Okay. We'll get some more information to everybody about this. Moving on then.
Madam Chair, the last area.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize there were more questions. Senator Laurie.
Thank you. Support grants. I see a large drop in this. Maybe I stepped out for 1 second. Maybe that was already covered, but it looks like $7 to $9 million cut in consumer support grants, which are allowing greater flexibility with essentially something a state share or less of what otherwise might be a Medicaid.
Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, as I understand this, this is the manner in which we do state accounting. It's not an actual drop as represented on these pages. And there's a transfer that occurs into this program as it is being used.
So we expect I'm looking at the bottom of 210A for
right.
Anybody who's looking for this. So we're expecting a continuation of this program at former levels. We're not eliminating it, is what it looks yeah. like.
Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, that's my understanding, yes.
And maybe you could get us the numbers that would show up for 08 and 09 if this page were showing the actual spending.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions on these pages? I thought I saw somebody else that had one.
Well,
Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Assistant Commissioner, on the Title II grants, the drug rebates, can I assume that same thought pattern applies to that? The 07 was quite large, and the 08-09 is substantially less. So the rebate... I don't understand those figures. The next page in 210C.
That would be it. So, okay, here, this one.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, again, my understanding is that is a function of how we account for these funds that. They're recognized as we're able to achieve the rebates. And again, we can do similarly an accounting for how that is treated on the budget pages.
It is kind of strange that it goes up so much and then back down again.
Madam Chair, I'm informed that part of that swing is the carry forward that allows for the rebates to continue to move from year to year for utilization in the program.
It's a lot of carry forward. We need to get more explanation of those numbers if we could. All right.
The last area can be found on page 213. which describes the management of continuing care programs. These are the resources that allow us to do the work that is required of us. Continuing care management, and these pages, really is a combination of some work in three different administrations, both continuing care, for which we've discussed today. There's some chemical and mental health administration in here, and also some Children's and Family Service Administration. We have on these pages represented about 239 FTEs in continuing care that I'm responsible for. Most of, but not all, of those positions are funded through the general fund. About 62% of the resources in our area is funded through the general fund. We have the balance who are funded through federal programs or special revenue streams. Examples would be the Older American Act funds that fund specific FTEs that we've referenced. The Ombudsman Services for nursing facilities is funded through federal funds. We've just been talking about HIV. The Ryan White Care Act funding flows through the Continuing Care Administration. There are also some special revenue funding streams. An example of that is in deaf and hard of hearing, where the telephone distribution system, the services are funded through a special revenue account, a fee that we're all assessed on our telephone bills in order to provide that service for deaf and hard of hearing and deaf-blind individuals. We've kind of talked about the divisions. The budget pages kind of line up with that. And so I don't know how much in more detail you want to discuss the five divisions within continuing care, the HIV division and some of the activities that they serve, nursing facility rates and policy, and we've talked about a number of the initiatives that we're responsible for in that area, the Deaf Services Division. I will make note that that's a little bit different than some of our other administration in that we have regional offices for deaf and hard of hearing services. We need to make sure that deaf and hard of hearing and deaf-blind individuals have full access in the communities, and we have learned that having regional offices out there to work with communities, consumers, employers, medical providers is the most effective way. We have the aging division that we've talked about and our administration of both federal and state programs. And then the Disability Services Division, which manages most but not all of the waiver programs that we talked about earlier, the Ticket to Work programs, the ICFMRs, et cetera. In addition, I'll call to your attention on page 213, there are a number of councils and boards that we support, beginning with the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People and on through the various structures and collaborations that we staff and work with. I was also asked to talk about what changes in positions since 2005 have occurred within our business areas, and we have received seven new positions in the last couple of years from the legislature, and of course we're appreciative of that. The specific activities that those individuals work on, four of those positions were appropriated to focus on the personal care attendant program and the changes that have been developed over the last several years to better assure that the services are meeting the needs of the individuals in the or who choose to use personal care attendant services. One FTE was allocated to implement the home and community-based service scholarship program as we're trying to work from within to develop opportunities for those that are in the workforce who wish to work in long-term care services. This was an expansion of a program that was already in existence for the institutional side of services. We have one FTE that was dedicated to work on relocation service coordination and other case management type system reforms. And we're in the early, well, we're just about ready to release the RFP to develop those very targeted services. And then the last FTE that we were allocated was to design and implement the long-term care partnership program, which is also almost ready for implementation, and we're working with Commerce to make sure that the training and the qualifications of long-term care insurance plans under this initiative will help people make good decisions in planning for their long-term care needs. So those are the recent changes to our administrative budgets.
Are there any questions about this area? Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, can you explain just a little bit more about the four FTEs for the personal care program? Did I understand that correctly?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, yes. There are a number of changes that have been developed to the personal care attendant program that required resources in order to implement. Let me note a couple of them. We needed to enroll or design a process and enroll all individuals who are providing personal care attendant services. Those are about 40,000 individuals that have been enrolled during the last year and a half. And they serve about 16,000 consumers. As part of that, although it's a different budget activity, but we had to work together on it, it required background checks on all of those individuals. We needed to standardize the physician form that indicates the statement of need. The personal care attendant program is initiated it's initiated by the consumer, but then they need the support of the physician to be able to identify and assess the need for these services. We implemented timesheets for all services that are provided under this program and synchronize that with payment to make sure that the individual who is receiving the services, the individual who says they're providing the services, and the organization who's going to get paid to distribute the funds are all in sync. And so to develop a mechanism to track those timesheets. We also modified the use agreement. We went to a every 6 month use agreement. It's called the flexible use agreement. So instead of developing a plan for 12 months, we went to a 6 month option where people could have the flexibility of using their hours during that 6 month period. And last but certainly not least, all of this requires a tremendous amount of training, a tremendous amount of interacting with the consumers so they understand how they are best able to manage the program, with the providers, with the medical community, with all the stakeholders to make sure that they understand the rules with which this program are managed and how the individuals are expected to behave. So there's a tremendous amount of activity that has taken place in this program the last couple of years.
And Senator Rosen, you might remember that some of this was initiated by the legislature because there was a huge growth in the number of provider organizations that were filing with the state, and there was a huge growth in expenditures in this area of the budget, and we did then generate some cost savings off of the reforms that were able to be reallocated within the budget to help pay for things like the COLA that wasn't in the governor's budget last session. So some of it also was followed by kind of similar federal requirements to more standardize the program and provide for more documentation or more accurate documentation of the need for the service.
Okay.
Other questions?
Okay. Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much. I think we have some time, and we're planning then on taking up a discussion of the forecast. Which cuts across all of the various components of the Department of Human Services budget, and we have this document, Trends in DHS Forecast Programs. And we have Katie Burns with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie Burns. I work in the Office of Management and Budget at the Department of Human Services and have the task this morning of walking you through some high-level trends related to our forecast programs. The presentation is intended to be a high-level overview, and there are a number of folks in the audience who can help answer more detailed questions that may crop up as we walk through these trends. And as Senator Berglund mentioned, this will cover all of the programs that you have heard about over the course of the past couple of weeks, and thought it would be helpful today to start just by reminding folks what it is that we mean by a forecast program. And a forecast program is a program for which the state has a legal obligation to provide a benefit or service to an eligible person. Estimates of these current law obligations are included in the state's forecast projections and are reflected in fund balance statements. And through the budget process, appropriations are adjusted to ensure that adequate resources are available to pay for these forecast programs. You'll see on the third slide of your presentation a table that lists all general fund financed forecast programs in DHS's budget and their estimated costs for the current biennium. You'll see that forecast programs account for almost $6.7 billion worth of spending, or 84% of our projected general fund spending in the current biennium, just to give you a sense of scope. I also want to note that there are other significant sources of funding for forecast programs, and those non-general fund financing streams will be incorporated into discussions of individual forecast programs as we work our way through today's presentation. I finally want to note that MinnesotaCare is not included on this list of forecast programs because it is, of course, funded through the Healthcare Access Fund and not the general fund, so it will be included in our presentation at a later point. We thought we would start, or we'd organize the presentation today by several of the business areas that you've heard about over the past couple of weeks. And we're going to start with continuing care, since that will be freshest in your mind from Assistant Commissioner Coleman's overview today. And then we'll get to basic health care and children and family services. And just to explain how this presentation is organized, what we'll do is to walk through the forecast programs in each of the business areas and start with 06-07 spending projections compared to projected growth in each of the programs in 08 and 09. And then we'll take an historical look at what's happened in each of those programs in terms of average monthly enrollment and average cost since the mid to late 1990s through the present. So this first bar graph compares spending on continuing care forecast programs in the current biennium with projections for fiscal year 2008 and 2009. And, of course, the forecast programs here include long-term care facilities, long-term care waivers, and chemical dependency entitlement. Across continuing care's three forecast programs, spending is projected to grow on a biennial basis by $310 million, or 11.2%. You can also look at that in terms of annual average growth from fiscal year 2006 to 2009 as a different point of comparison, and that annual average growth rate is 5.1%. In terms of the individual budget activities that are covered here, long-term care facility spending is projected to decline by $34 million, or 3.4% between the two biennia, and that's an annual average decrease of 2.1%.
And if I could just ask you, I know at least last biennium, as a part of this forecast, you were projecting closures, the number of facilities that you thought might close, and thereby we would no longer include that spending in our budget. And I'm wondering if this forecast also has closure anticipated in it.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask for some help in answering that question.
Madam Chair, we, George Hoffman, Department of Human Services, we budgeted, anticipated a substantial number of facility closures above what we had been seeing in the trend based on a 2005 budget initiative to encourage development of single bed rooms in nursing facilities. And we, from that, we anticipated the closure of an additional 3,000 beds. And not much of that actually happened. It was the actual closures caused by those incentives were in the low hundreds rather than the thousands. And so we adjusted those additional closures and the impacts on the nursing home caseload and on the elderly waiver caseload, we adjusted most of those effects out of the forecast in the, especially in the November 06 forecast, we adjusted much of that out. We had been anticipating faster decreases in the nursing home caseload, and we had been anticipating additional increases in elderly waiver caseload caused by the closing of beds. So those large effects based on the 05 initiative are out of the forecast, except to the extent that they had some influence on the history. We do continue to anticipate small numbers of closings. Based on our experience over the last several years. I don't know those numbers offhand, but it's a very modest number of closings of beds, and it's part of the reason that we are forecasting a continuing decrease in the nursing facility caseload. We've seen the nursing facility caseload going down at 4 to 5% a year in recent years. We forecast that decline is going to continue at a rate of 3 to 4% a year. So we're forecasting continuing decline, but the changes from those 05 initiatives have been taken out of the forecast.
Mr. Hoffman, one of the reasons that I'm asking this question is because every year I have at least one, if not a dozen, organizations come to my office proposing that we increase the spending on home and community-based long-term care services for the elderly, and if we did so, that we would be able to pay for it with additional nursing home bed closures. And when we've looked at that in the past, the closures would have to be above and beyond what are anticipated anyway. And they also have to pay for the loss of the surcharge revenues. And when you get done with all of that, there really isn't much left. And I'm just trying to see whether you believe that if we increased spending on home and community-based services, could we then anticipate more savings from additional nursing home bed closures?
Madam Chair, we already forecast fairly aggressive growth in elderly waiver caseload and very slow growth in alternative care caseload. We use both of those forecasts as independent variables in forecasting MA nursing home caseload, and we are already anticipating some further decline in nursing home caseload because of the growth we are forecasting in the alternative programs. And so
I think these folks are talking about non-forecasted program expenditures, increasing non-forecasted expenditures on community-based care for the elderly.
Then, Madam Chair, I tend to ask for the data that would support the claims that it will have an effect on the nursing facility caseload.
All right. I'll be sure to ask them for that when they come to see me then. Thank you. Why don't we continue?
Okay, we'll pick back up in talking about long-term care waiver spending in the current biennium. And it's expected to increase by $319 million, or 19.5% from fiscal year 2006-07 to the next biennium. That's an annual average increase of 9.1% between fiscal years 2006 and 2009. And then finally, in the continuing care area, chemical dependency entitlement spending is projected to grow by $25 million, or 18.1% between the two biennia, and that's an annual average increase of 7.7%.
Any other questions? And the long-term care waiver increase is due primarily to the increased acuity of people in the program, or is it increased numbers? I thought we had a cap on the slots, so.
We do have a cap on slots through the current biennium. There are a number of issues that are going on with the waiver spending.
Is this reflective of the caps going off in the next biennium? Is that?
Madam Chair, that is one of the important factors in the growth. We have caseload caps in place on the CADI and the TBI waivers. Those caps expire at the end of the current biennium, and so we are forecasting some additional enrollment growth in those waivers after the caps come off, and so part of the growth is from more people, both in those waivers and elderly waiver especially. And then part of the growth is annualization of the COLAs that occurred in the current biennium and other trends in the cost of care in these programs.
Okay, thank you. Let's go on then.
The next slide demonstrates long-term trends related to the settings in which long-term care services are provided. So this looks at a broad overview of our facilities and waiver budget activities. And as we've already talked about, facility-based care is on the decline, while use of waivered services has increased steadily over time. And as you know, waivers are programs that provide home and community-based services as an alternative to institutional care. I just want to note that there's a small red line at the fiscal year 2007 mark at the bottom of this line graph. And what that does is to divide actual data from forecast estimates, and you'll see that small red line show up as we work our way through the presentation. So just wanted to make sure folks knew what that was there for. The number of long-term care facility recipients declined by an annual average rate of 4% per year between fiscal years 1997 and 2006. And, of course, 2006 would be the most recent year for which we have completed enrollment information. That's a decline of just over 10,000 average monthly recipients in those 9 years. And this decline is expected to continue over the forecast horizon. The number of home and of waiver and home care recipients, however, increased by roughly 24,000, or an annual average of 8.3% between fiscal years 1997 and 2006. So again, reflective of those broad trends that we've talked about. Looking at the next page, we thought it would be of interest to the committee to look at individual waiver programs and what's happened within each of those categories. So again, we're talking about the DD waiver, elderly waiver, CADI, CAC, and TBI, all of which you just learned about this morning or heard more about. So this chart provides trend information on monthly average recipients in each waiver program, as well as a sense of the relative scope of participation in each waiver program. And as you can see, the enrolled populations are quite different in size. Between fiscal years 1997 and 2006, the DD waivers average monthly recipients increased by almost 8,500, which is an annual average growth rate of 10.6% over that time period. In the elderly waiver, average monthly recipients increased by roughly 9,300. That's an annual average growth rate of 12.6%. In the CADI waiver, average monthly recipients increased by approximately 6,900, which is an annual average growth rate of 19%. CAC average monthly recipients increased by 75, and that's an annual average growth rate of 5.1%. And in the TBI waiver, average monthly recipients increased by approximately 900, an annual average of 19.3%.
And while we do a lot of worrying around here, legitimately so, about health care cost increases in general, this area of our budget is far and away the largest expenditure area. So when we hear somebody at the table talking about 10, 11% annual increases, we know that our budget isn't increasing 10 or 11% annually. So that is of concern as to whether we can continue to provide the quality services that can keep people in the community or in any facility without having those kind of increases.
We're going to take an average a look at average monthly costs. Again, this is stepping back in the long-term care area and taking a broader look at the facilities and waivers and waiver budget activities. And we see that the long-term trend here, not surprisingly, is increased costs in both facilities and waiver budget activities. Long-term care facility average costs increased by an annual average growth rate of 3.2% between fiscal years 1997 and 2006. And average costs for long-term care facility recipients are driven mainly by changes in facility rates, including COLA increases. Long-term care waiver and home care average monthly costs increased by an annual average of 6.3% between fiscal years 1997 and 2006. Average costs for long-term care waiver recipients are also driven by COLA increases, as well as changes in individual service plans and changes in the mix of higher and lower cost recipients in the various services. Then in terms of looking at the individual waiver programs, again, and average monthly cost within those waivers, between fiscal years 1997 and 2006, DD average monthly costs increased 3.9% on an average annual basis. Elderly waiver average monthly costs grew by an annual average rate of 10.5% over that time period. CADI increased by an annual average of 12.6%. The CAC waiver, which as you can see, there's not been a consistent trend in average costs in this waiver. when we look over that long time period, decreased by an annual average rate of 2%. And TBI, with a more steady trend, increased by an annual average of 7.4% over that 9-year period.
Any questions so far? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's pretty dramatic to look at the differences between the expenditures for long-term care and then waivers. Is anyone tracking the savings, total savings to the state then for making these shifts? Because there's a pretty dramatic amount between what we're spending on home and community-based services compared to long-term care. And if that is a savings, typically speaking, per patient or per resident that's moved from one system to another, do we have an idea of how much money we're saving over the course of time?
Well, we must keep track of it in order to renew our waivers, because we only get the waivers based on the fact that they are cost-effective and a reduction of expenditures over what we would otherwise be spending. But we've had these waivers in place for a long time, so, you know, I guess after a while you get to the point where you have to say, would we have kept creating residential facilities to place all of these individuals if we hadn't had the waivers? So it gets to be kind of a, you know, what if the car was never invented? Well, it gets kind of hard to even think of it. what would society be like? You know, it's. But you must keep track somehow for purposes of renewing waivers. What the cost effectiveness is of the waiver programs.
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes. The federal requirement is a very simple one, and that is that the average cost of service in the waiver per person must be no more than the average cost for the corresponding institutional service. But the question is, the real question of cost effectiveness is a very difficult one, because we know that when we serve people with home and community-based waivers, we tend to serve more people. And so it's not, it's not as simple as saying for every waiver person, we're saving the difference between what that sort of person would cost in an institution. And so it's not a straightforward calculation.
Any other questions? Let's keep going then.
Okay. We have two slides on our chemical dependency entitlement placements. And the first slide looks at annual placements. And between fiscal years 1997 and 2006, annual placements increased by 9,200, an annual average growth rate of 4.8%. And in our second slide, having to do with chemical dependency treatment fund placement costs, we see that cost per treatment placement has risen modestly over time, with the exception of a one-time decrease in fiscal year 2001. When we look over the 9-year period from fiscal years 1997 through 2006, costs rose 2.9% on an average annual basis.
Mm-hmm.
folks are ready to continue, we'll move into the basic health care cost segment of our briefing. And so this is the second of three major program areas that we'll talk about today. And again, we start with a bar graph that compares projected general fund and health care access fund spending in the current biennium with fiscal year 2008 and 09 projections for the four basic health care forecasted programs. And those programs are, of course, MA Families with Children, MA Elderly and Disabled, GAMC, General Assistance Medical Care, and Minnesota Care. Across these four basic health care programs, spending is projected to grow by almost $900 million between the current biennium and fiscal year 2008 and 9, or 22%. And again, looking at that more on an average annual growth rate from fiscal years 2006 to 2009, that average annual rate of change is 10.5%.
Ms. Burns, I'm going to have to stop you because we've run out of our committee time today.
Okay.
And so I think we'll ask you to come back and we'll start with this page on basic health care.
Okay.
The next committee meeting.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Which is tomorrow. Thank you. And members, if you can save this document in your folder so you'll have it tomorrow, that would be appreciated.
George with all of the deaths on the
right.
Answers is
right.
We need him.
So I'm jumping to tomorrow.